This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Reverend Michael Mulberry, pastor of Community United Church of Christ, and we're talking about the practicing congregation. Now that's kind of a new term, Mike. What does it mean?
It's about being intentional as a congregation. I think that for so long, what we had in a lot of our mainline congregations is a diversity of folks who blurred their identity, and we blurred their identity sometimes intentionally because we wanted to be as inclusive as possible of values and ideas and the different people we would have come into our congregations. Practicing congregation says that we're going to be intentional about our identity and also about our vocation, who we are and who we are going to be in our community.
So these would be Christian congregations that are choosing to be open and welcoming, but also to say who they are.
Yeah, to say who they are in their communities. That's, I think, really critical at this particular time when I think it has been related how our media is controlled so tightly these days at a political level, at an economic level, so that the messages that we hear every day are just pounded into us day after day after day until we realize that we're consumers or, you know, as I can say, is that I now think that having dandruff is a social problem that I have because the commercials or the message tells me how broken I am because I have that particular malady. Mm-hmm. So churches need to respond in some way by offering something that they repeat over and over as their identity that's an alternative to that kind of understanding.
So part of it's an issue of who people in a religious community, how they self-identify and how they communicate that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Is you want to be able to say who you are and then be able to say that in your community, recognizing that when you do that, you will create immediate conflict probably within your congregation at first as you work out that identity, and then second in the community as people respond to that identity, probably both positively and negatively.
Now, what's going on that right now is an important time to talk about these sort of things, practicing congregations?
Well, I think part of it, Steve, comes out of an understanding that for so long, probably until the 1960s, the culture or the wider culture carried mainline denominations that we can remember back in the time when town hall meetings were held in those congregational churches in the Northeast, that there was a mingling of religion and government that the mainline denominations didn't say was wrong, but almost celebrated. Now we've arrived at a different time in which mainline denominations are very fearful of that intermingling between government and religion and recognize that they are not the ones being carried by the culture, that the more fundamentalist and evangelical congregations are being carried by that culture. And that makes things hard for mainlines to, if mainlines are going to get their identity out there, they're going to have to be clear about that. They can't blur it because we're receiving so much information so fast.
So currently in American culture, evangelical Christian Protestant groups have a lot of political influence. Many people think that that's the only kind of Christianity there is. What has happened? Well, tell us who the mainline groups are and tell us what's happened to them.
Well, mainline groups are Presbyterian Church USA, United Methodist Church. I would even include Mennonite and Brethren within that group, United Church of Christ, our denomination, I'm trying to think of and going blank about some of the
probably Lutheran
Evangelical uh-huh. Lutheran Church of America, uh-huh. Yeah. So those are churches that have found their resource in ancient kind of traditions out of that Protestant understanding and now are trying to find who they are in this modern or postmodern age. And, you know, you see the splits happening, and they really, I think, found their genesis in the 60s when civil rights, the Vietnam War, so many of those things created chaos in churches, to borrow a phrase from Jack Good, my predecessor at Community UCC. And the question was, could those mainline churches survive that chaos that was created, or would that rift, that chaos that we experienced, split us so far that we could not recover? And the answer is mixed. And I think that the churches that are finding success are working hard, intentionally working on who they are and who they are in their community. And I also wanted to read something that comes from Richard Horsley, who I believe is one of the great critics of the empire and empire theology, because I believe we've reached a time where, much like the fourth century, where Constantine melded Christianity into the understanding of the church, that he believes that we have something similar going on today. And he talks about this elaborate festival that goes on. It has a great festival celebrated in honor of the birth of the Lord and Savior of the world, the Prince of Peace, a man who was also worshipped as divine. A great festival celebrating not only the beginning of the new year, but also the beginning of a new era, which began with the Savior's birth. A great festival celebrating abundance with indulgence and feasting, drinking, and gift giving. A great festival during which the poor were recipients of the philanthropy and generous giving of the rich, so that they could enjoy food at least once a year when all feasted on sumptuous fare. A great festival whose presence virtually pervaded public space, visually and otherwise. A prolonged festival filled with a surfeit of public entertainments in song, dance, theater, and athletic games. A prolonged festival during which political, local political, and religious leaders presided over various rituals and ceremonies. A prolonged festival in which the very wealthy people of the city sponsored parades and lavish public displays that both entertained the masses and brought their own names to public attention. A prolonged festival in which sales of goods and services flourished at no other time of the year. And a great festival that brought a sense of unity to the civic community while honoring the Savior. Now, that all sounds like modern-day America. That also was first-century Rome, and into the world in which Jesus was born. So there is a sense that we have become that Roman Empire, and there are some people who are on the edges that are saying that's not who we wanted to be as a Christian faith, that we are so closely tied to that understanding of who we are.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Mike Mulberry, pastor at Community United Church of Christ in Champaign, about the practicing congregation movement. If you have a question for our guest or a comment on things we're talking about, do give us a call. The toll-free number, anywhere the program is heard, including on the Internet, is 1-800-222-9455. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. And I see we have a caller on our toll-free line, line 4. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Isn't the main defining characteristic of the organizations which you describe as mainline Protestant, with the possible exception of the Mennonites and the Brethren, isn't the main defining characteristic of these organizations the rejection of the faith which was once delivered to the saints, Orthodox Christianity? Thank you.
Well, I think that's all over the board. I think that those faiths respond to that in a diverse kind of way. I think that what is faithful and what is not is always up for debate. One of the things that we were taught in seminary, at least, with a strong emphasis on community, is that no one person has the consensus understanding of what it means to be Orthodox or be part of that tradition. Although Orthodoxy is defined sometimes by our adjudicatories and wider church ministries within every denomination, there's a certain sense that there is a diversity of opinion that mainlines have not really worked out to decide who they are. I think some of that diversity is rather scary for mainlines because they know that to come to the table will begin with some disagreements among the folk. And part of what practicing congregations is all about is being brave enough to enter into that diversity, to begin a discussion, to find some unity and to say, where can we find agreement? Where can we find a way that defines all of us, or at least a number of us that will help us walk out into the future?
In terms of mainline Christian groups, although there is great diversity, how many of them have stopped baptizing people or have stopped celebrating the Lord's Supper or have stopped considering Scripture as very important? How many have stopped worshiping God? I think although many mainline churches try to welcome people who may not be able to affirm the most ancient of creeds, that there's still very much a central Christian commitment there among most people.
Yeah, and I think some of that it happens out of a sense that there is great meaning in those rites and rituals. Some folks who have clear understanding of what those rites and rituals means. I think others pick up almost, I would say there's an intuition that there is something meaningful here. I'm not quite sure what it is, but I'm hanging on for it. And you know, that has happened within our church in which, Tracy, my life partner, Reverend Tracy Heilman, who's the director of religious education, and myself, we are trying to make sure that within those rituals, we are doing intentional identity and vocational kinds of things. So that one of the things that we have our children repeating as we go through baptism is that no matter what the world calls me, no matter who people say that I am, I will shout it from the rooftops that, and then the children respond, I am a child of God. And so that we are trying to get an intentional practice, much like somebody might go through rosary beads, and I always refer to it as, I want you to know down to your last red blood cell that you are a child of God, when the culture is telling you so many giving you so many messages about who you are. And within the Christian church, for example, I think one of the debates that is going on presently, as I talked to a friend who's a professor of worship and liturgy at Eden Theological Seminary in St. Louis, is whether the repentance and forgiveness model works within worship, which has been a model that all of those mainline institutions have used for a long, long time, and a field that what we have done is made people focus in on sin for a long, long time, and maybe that needs to be abandoned in favor of something that's broader, that still includes confession at different times, but recognizing that that's not the whole of the Christian message. So I think you're right, is I think that there are things that hold the main lines together in terms of tradition and rite and ritual that they do. But I also think people are asking for a chance to review those things so that they might get to know what the specific content of each of those practices is all about.
When you talk about a practicing congregation and what some of these practices are, some of that I know from talking to you earlier is based on research. And tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the person who is leading the way in that or has led the way so far is a person called Diana Butler Bass. She did a study that was endowed by Lilly in which she collected data from a number of mainline churches, and she wanted to really focus in on churches that were either in the middle to liberal, because she felt like conservative churches had been studied ad nauseum. So what she did is she went in and focused, pared it down to about 50 churches that she saw as thriving and vital, and then pared it down even further to 10 churches, and they were all across the board. They really went for churches that were rural, urban, suburban, churches that had non-white congregations or diverse congregations, and also all across the board denominationally. I see in a chart that she has prepared, one was UCC, two were Presbyterian, one was United Methodist. They had two that were Evangelical Lutheran Church of the America. And so they went all over the board, and she found that there were specific practices that each of those churches were using as they went forward. They were diverse practices, but at the same time, they were intentionally doing those practices.
Give us some examples. What are some of the things that Diana Butler Bass, discovered in this study funded by the Lilly Foundation?
Here are some of the practices that she put out there. Discernment, hospitality, testimony, adult formation, shaping community, working for social justice, healing, small groups, prayer practices, stewardship, practice of the presence of God, and contemplative prayer. She also talks about the congregation that you were just mentioning before we started, Trinity Episcopal, which is the oldest Protestant congregation and the oldest building in the United States. She talks about how they had 1,000 families in 1960, and in 2000 they had 40 to 50 people in their congregation. And they set about going about these identity and vocation tasks, and they did it with an out gay Episcopalian priest. And he was sent there, it is believed, because they were about to close. So he was to clean that all up. And it was ended up being a church where everyone had been kicked out of another congregation. And what they decided to do was practice deep prayer and also a labyrinth ministry. And after 3 years, they went from 80 people to 600 people. And again, numbers are not always an indicator of a vital congregation, but certainly during this time, she believes that that made a huge difference for Trinity Episcopal in their vitality.
We're talking with Mike Mulberry, who's pastor at Community United Church of Christ in Champaign. Mike, where is your church located?
It's at the corner of Daniel and 6th Streets. We are right in the middle of campus, not too far away from McKinley Presbyterian and McKinley Foundation. And we are surrounded by students and the campus, and we think in a great place.
Now, it's a congregation that's been active in this community for a long time.
Yeah, it has. We had some great pastors that preceded me. I inherit a wonderful tradition. Lionel Miles was there as the congregations came together to form Community UCC. And then Jack Good was the most recent settled pastor. And Jack was one of my heroes within the United Church of Christ, probably because Jack was so deliberate and very careful about everything that he said and did and was so intentional, while I tend to be somebody who will speak at length. And I've always admired that about Jack and wish I could be more like him. But we have very different gifts, and he is still one of the people who I think gives life to this congregation with the legacy that he has left.
Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Metamora, Illinois, a small football community just outside of Peoria, about 10 to 15 minutes outside of Peoria.
What's a football community?
Well, they have finished first in the state once and I think second about four or five times. And, you know, we had those big old farm boys that grew up as linemen. And your greatest dream in Metamora was to grow up to be the quarterback of the football team and to be, if you were female, to be the head cheerleader. So that was kind of how things worked in Metamora. And it says something about my particular stand that I was a baseball player. My dad was the head baseball coach there. So, grew up in a UCC church that was a amalgamation of several different churches and probably got known, as many UCC churches are in small communities, as the compromise churches. If you couldn't be married in one church or another, you went to the UCC church in town to get married, and folks who were debating about their faith back and forth ended up in that particular place.
Where did you go to college?
I went to college at Illinois Wesleyan University and majored in history and minored in German and religion there, and then on to the University of Illinois College of Law that I scraped by on my knuckles to get through, and graduated from there and practiced law for about a year, and then went to seminary in St. Louis at Eden.
Why did you leave law to go to seminary?
Well, that's multifaceted in some ways. I was bad as a law student. I was bad as a lawyer, and knew that it wasn't the right thing. And my boss at the time embezzled about $500,000. And so I thought it was about time to get to seminary. And I knew that eventually that I paint that in a real poor way. But I knew eventually I did want to go to seminary. I felt a strong calling towards Latin America and some of the issues that were going on there as I learned more and more about what was going on in El Salvador, and served a year in mission in Guatemala and southern Mexico and Chiapas, working with Guatemala refugees and the displaced in Chiapas. So,
now, when you went to seminary, of course, as a college student, as a law student, I'm sure you're open to looking at many different aspects of religion and faith and spirituality. Why did you stick with the tradition out of which you grew up?
Number one, Eden gave me a full ride. So that's one of the things because of my undergraduate grades. But I think also as I began to learn more about the United Church of Christ, I recognized that I was probably congregational in my orientation in terms of polity. And I was also a person who loved the history as that the Congregationalists, particularly in Illinois, have a long history of being an abolitionist church, that this church that I pastor now, Community UCC, has a history with Goose Pond, in which Abraham Lincoln spoke there. And so many of those churches along the I-80 corridor are abolitionist churches that Lewis Tappan, who was the guy who headed out the Amistad event to provide solidarity for those African people, he came and founded over 150 congregational churches in Illinois. And, of course, Owen Lovejoy is a part of that tradition, too. And I grew up in a town where we had a Lincoln courthouse and where Lincoln practiced law. So that Lincoln tradition ran pretty strong through me. So that was pretty strong. And then I learned about the Evangelical and Reform branch of the UCC that was involved with health care for the poor, built evangelical health systems in Chicago, and just fell in love with the denomination where I grew up in a local church that did not have much information. I was incredibly cared for, but we did not know much about what it meant to be UCC.
Now, the United Church of Christ is one of the leaders among Protestant Christian churches currently in terms of being open to gay and lesbians. Has that been an important issue for you?
Yeah, that's been an important issue for me. And I told you beforehand, it even meant a lot to me in my call, in that my hometown church, I basically had to leave because I disagreed with the pastor on the inclusion of the gay and lesbian community. And he saw to it that I would not be ordained in my hometown church. So I found a church out in Arthur, Illinois, where my pastor, where I was as a boy, Reverend Ken Rader, and an incredible person for me in my faith development, was pastor there and was ordained by those two churches, Tuscola UCC and Zion UCC in Arthur. So that was a very bumpy ride, but it was a ride in which I kind of got to say, well, I'm doing this, getting ordained, not because I want to be liked as the oldest child, which is part of my history, but because I do sense a real call to do something that God has called me to.
Mm-hmm. Now you're married.
Yes.
You have a child?
I do. I have two boys that live with their mom up in Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin, Jacob and Abraham. And then I have a daughter, Sophia Rose, who is mine with Reverend Tracy Heilman. And she is like her mom, an incredibly strong four-year-old. And I tell Tracy all the time that she's strong such that when she turns 16, I'm going to buy a lifetime supply of popcorn and watch two strong women go at it because they're already fighting over turf. But they, I have an, you know, I would say it sounds overly romantic sometimes, but my wife is the theologian that I most admire and respect. She is doing incredible things with the children and youth of our community to bring progressive theology to children and youth, which is really difficult when most all of the resources are geared towards something that's much more conservative and much easier to do because the culture repeats it for them.
Sure. Did Tracy go to Eden?
She did not. She went to Phillips Theological Seminary in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We were best of friends at that time. And when she did that, I thought I'd lost my best friend because I couldn't imagine that Tulsa, Oklahoma would have a seminary that would rhyme with my theology. But Phillips is a little haven of progressive theology there. They have a number of Jesus Seminar scholars at Phillips. And I did my New Testament training with Steve Patterson, who is the foremost Gospel of Thomas scholar in the world. So it was great to sync up with Tracy when we got back together again and started dating during her third year of seminary.
When you came here to Champaign-Urbana, where had you been before that?
I'd been to a little community outside of the Quad Cities called Atkinson, Illinois, just outside of Geneseo. I'd been a youth pastor at Community UCC in Morton, Illinois, and I had been to Wichita, Kansas, where I was a member of Fairmount UCC, which founded Wichita State University, and then and was an abolitionist church, and also Pilgrim UCC, which was a great church to be in Wichita. Is what's great about pastoring churches in Wichita, Kansas, is you are not going to find any Rush's Right bumper stickers in the parking lot. These many of those churches are, in many ways, practicing congregations, because to be UCC in that neck of the woods, you are making a clear statement about who you are.
Mm-hmm.
So
we're talking with Mike Mulberry about the practicing congregation movement. Mike is pastor of Community United Church of Christ in Champaign. If you have a question or a comment about what we're discussing, please give us a call. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Elsewhere, if you're listening even on the Internet, anywhere in the continental U.S., you may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs on Sunday evenings from 5 to 6, even when the Super Bowl isn't playing.
Yeah.
Next week, my guest will be Matthew Murray. He's a poet in Urbana. He'll be reading his poetry and talking about the creative process. On February 19th, our guest will be Youssef Estes. He'll be talking about why priests and pastors are accepting Islam. They'll also be speaking in Champaign-Urbana at Gregory Hall on February 16 at 7 o'clock. That's a free admission. And there'll be a fundraising dinner and lecture sponsored by the Muslim Women's Outreach on February 18, Saturday, at 5:30 at the University Y. That does cost $10. It has limited seating. If you'd like to make reservations, go to muslimpreacher.com. That's Muslim, M-U-S-L-I-M, preacher.com. Muslim Women's Outreach presenting Youssef Estes. As I say, he'll be here on Keeping the Faith February 19th. If folks would like to listen and ask questions to someone who has converted from Christianity to Islam. On February 26th, we'll be talking with Hillel Hakim. He's an Israeli journalist who'll be in town giving some talks on Keeping the Faith. He'll be talking about Christian churches and Israel. Those are some of the programs coming up here on Keeping the Faith. These programs are sponsored in part, supported in part, by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. The Y is the oldest religious institution at the University of Illinois, and since 1873 has been providing opportunities for students to become leaders by being involved in social action, community service. We have many programs at the Y. One of our popular forums is called Friday Forum, and last week we heard on Friday Bill Schultz, who is the executive director of Amnesty International, who gave a great talk. If you missed that, you could pick up a video or audio tape of that at the Y. Coming up on next Friday, Marcos Popovich will be talking. He's from the United States Hispanic Leadership Institute, and he'll be talking about the renewal of the Voting Rights Act and its implications for minority voters. That's Friday at noon at the University Y, 1001 South Wright Street. You can get to that easily by bus, or there's some parking as students leave from their morning classes. It's right at noon at the Y. Know Your University starts this coming Tuesday. We have a series each semester, and Jim Nowlin, who's the director of the Civic Leadership Program at the university, will be talking about that. That's this coming Tuesday, February 7. And then on February 14, you might want to make an appointment with your sweetheart to come and hear Dr. Barrington Coleman sing Sounds for Valentine's Day, Tuesday, February 14 at noon at the Y. Community classes start at the Y coming up tomorrow. We had a whole program on those last week. I won't repeat that except to say if you'd like to learn how to dance or learn how to do special cooking from the Philippines, for example, or several courses on religion and spirituality and films and exercise and martial arts and all kinds of things, check out our website, universityymca.org. Click on Community for those fascinating, inexpensive, non-credit courses that will be starting up, many of them tomorrow. Well, we have two callers waiting on our local lines. Let's go to line one. You're on the air with Mike Mulberry. Go ahead.
Hi. Growing up in the 50s and early 60s and in the Presbyterian Church, there was no information about how you become a responsible sexual adult, how you avoid pitfalls, how you interact responsibly with other people, et cetera. I realize that was a different time. I'm no longer affiliated with the church, and the only church that I'm aware of that I happen to have bumped into that has an explicit program about sexuality for teens. I've heard about the Unitarian Church having one that they call About Your Sexuality. It's a multi-session program that the Unitarians have developed with guidelines, and I'm not sure what its current status is in terms of what kinds of things they do. But I was wondering whether you would care to speak to that. And, Steve, I was wondering whether that might be a topic that you might be interested in if you hadn't already talked about that sometimes with your guests or have a special theme about that, because it seems to me that how we interact around our sexuality affects so many different aspects of our lives and our happiness. And it's, I think a lot of us tend to think if you don't talk about it, people won't do it. And it's not just a question of what people do, but it's a question of how we interact and how we try to figure out what's going on. And when we don't talk about it, we tend to muddle through much less successfully than if we had a chance to talk about it ahead of time. So, thoughts?
Mike? Well, I think you're right on the money. I don't think that an experience in a Presbyterian church would have been singular for that particular time. Is that, and I think even today, we are all struggling to find a way to talk about sexuality. I think one of the most difficult things is because we haven't talked about it, once again, we know that there will be conflict when we begin the discussion, is that although we can agree to the basics, one of the things that we probably can know right away is that when we talk about the specifics, we will have a diversity of opinions. For example, is premarital sex a good idea? particularly with a four-year-old daughter, I think about that, and my immediate reaction is panicked, because I would not want her life cut short by having the responsibility of a child because she had premarital sex. At the same time, I know that I struggled and muddled through and would want her to have all the information to make informed decisions, to enjoy her body and know who she was as a sexual person. I know my wife is trained with the Our Whole Lives curriculum and is looking for opportunities to teach that. And that's an award-winning curriculum from the United Church of Christ dealing with sexuality. So it's out there. It is just getting folks like yourself into the mainline church to demand that it happen, so that pastors are not the ones who have to take the full frontal assault from folks who would rather keep it under the carpet. Because I think beyond sex and politics, beyond politics and money, I should say, sex is the one issue that we still struggle to talk about. And I even mean beyond, I heard you saying, as it pertains to behavior, not as it is in regards to orientation. I think our church does a fairly good job of talking about orientation in its leadership, but we still have not kind of blown the lid off of trying to talk about sexual behavior and what that means to our teenagers. And, you know, even to, you know, this is one issue that's not talked about. What does it mean for senior citizens who have had maybe a spouse die, or folks that are growing older and would like to continue a sexual life and wonder what the stigma will be as they try to map that out? We are not talking about that. And I agree with you, caller. I hope that in the future sometime we can begin that discussion in all of our denominations, because it will benefit all of us.
I know the Presbyterian Church better than others, and I do know, and in recent years there have been some very good materials, curricula developed to teach human sexuality, and some of them are quite good. At the church where I was pastor here in Champaign-Urbana for many years, McKinley Church, there was always at least every other year, and it may have been every year, a segment on sexuality that was age-appropriate, as well as discussion groups among adults where that could be chosen as a topic. So I think things have changed a lot from the time you were describing, at least in some congregations and some denominations. But I also think it'd be a good thing for us to talk about here on Keeping the Faith one of these days. So I'll try to find some people to share some of their experience. Let's go to another caller who's been waiting very patiently on line number two. Yes, go right ahead.
Hello. I am wondering what is meant by the phrase abolitionist congregations.
Those congregations who were anti-slavery and were actively part of the Underground Railroad in Illinois.
They were trying to abolish slavery.
Right, uh-huh. Right. In fact, you know, Owen Lovejoy became a very strong abolitionist because his brother Elijah ran an abolitionist newspaper in Alton, Illinois, and Elijah was killed by an angry mob and died in Owen's arms. And out of that experience, Owen vowed very much to become a strong abolitionist himself. So it was to oppose slavery during those times. And as we well know, Owen Lovejoy was a person who was very responsible for Lincoln receiving the Republican nomination out of the state of Illinois.
And perhaps we could tie together the issues of the last two callers and point out that at the time when slavery was being debated in this state, in this area, in this country, there were many Christian pastors who were quoting Scripture and saying that slavery was somehow all right, and other Christian pastors and leaders were quoting other parts of Scripture and trying to abolish the whole institution of slavery. And in many ways, I think that parallels what we're going through in the country today in terms of the sexuality issues, particularly in terms of gay and lesbian folks. And you have you have the same split.
Yeah, you do. And it's difficult because you want to try to come to the table to have a discussion. And I think a lot of mainline pastors have been frustrated by trying to make a table or a space where that might happen. And but I know that at the same time, Tracy and I have friends that are members in fundamentalist and evangelical denominations that don't agree with their pastors and have gay and lesbian friends. So it's not a question of rank and file in many of these churches. Probably in my church, too, I could safely assume that there aren't there probably are people who do not agree with the number of gay and lesbian people we have in our congregation and that those folks could be considered Christians. But I think what we're finding, at least at Community UCC, and I think it's probably true that Heidi would say at McKinley Presbyterian, that these folks who come into our midst from the gay and lesbian community are tremendous gifts to our congregations. The things that they bring to us, that I think it's a way of God saying that if you choose to turn these folk aside, it is not they who shall lose, but it is you as congregations. At least that has been my experience so far.
In terms of the practicing congregation movement that Diana Butler Bass has written about and studied with the help of the Lilly Foundation, are some of the congregations that she studied active in supporting discussions of sexuality, open to gays and lesbians, those kind of very liberal progressive causes?
Yes, there are many that are. But what she is finding out of that is that these congregations don't get caught up in liberal conservative battles and that that's a key to their success. I'm not sure about where I fall in all of that because I believe that and battles is probably the wrong word, but struggles. I think that some of those struggles and conflicts are necessary to go forward. And I think avoiding the fact that we have to deal with some of the political issues is just, to a degree, burying your head in the sand to go forward. I want to make sure that as a church that we recognize ourselves as not only a spiritual entity, but as Jesus understood, that you can't separate the spiritual from the political or the economic. That's not to say that we have to draw lines and have wars, but I do believe that we should be inviting folks to have conversations about their whole lives. I think those discussions are out there. What she has found is that what you want to do is point folks to the fact that the discussions you're going to have or the enterprise that you are is profoundly spiritual. I guess how I would sum that up, and this is my perspective and not Diana Butler Bass's, is there's a group called Borderlinks that's out of Tucson, Arizona, that works with migrant ministries associated with that doggone Presbyterian Church USA that you're a part of, Steve. They do wonderful ministry there. And one of the things that Rick Uffer Chase, who is now the moderator of the Presbyterian Church USA and the founder of Borderlinks, has said is, what we need to do is find ways to be church. They formed what they called a group called the Samaritans that goes out into the desert with a satellite phone, someone who is medical staff, and they find migrants who have broken a leg or who have some kind of health concern, and they are the church out in the desert. Now, is that a political enterprise that they're doing? Is that spiritual? Yeah, it's profoundly spiritual, and it's economic as well. So they're also doing a coffee cooperative, working with microcredit. I think that that is the work of the church.
When you think of when you try to help people in your congregation self-identify and communicate about that, what are some of the issues that you think are most important right now?
I think, as my congregation would say, because I've taken the stick out and beaten them with it several times in sermons, but the war has to be one of those issues that is talked about on an ongoing basis. The ongoing loss of life, the need to have interfaith discussions about what is going on, The war raises all kinds of issues that are necessary for who we are going to be, that identifies us outside of being identified as United States citizens. What does it mean to be Christian in this time and place? And sometimes I think we're a little bit afraid to answer that question. We'd rather take on what it means to be United States citizens. I think the other issue that you have related a couple of different times is how the inclusion of the gay and lesbian community into not only our spiritual life and worship, but also into the public sphere through marriage, the stand that our national church has taken, that all people should have equal right and protection within the institution of marriage. I also think the continuing ethnic struggles around the world and the global debt that exacerbates those struggles, so that those are discussions that have to happen. And in this particular community, one that we have not had much discussion in, where there's a gaping hole now, and there are ministries trying to step up to meet it. But when Hugh Phillips left, the incredible ministry that we lost for the migrant population in this community, that is a growing population as folks who are coming north, who have lost their farms as subsistence farmers in that same place in southern Mexico where I worked, and are trying to find a livelihood for their or a way to live for their loved ones, and on their way to Chicago are stopping in Champaign and sometimes staying permanently. As Hugh Phillips said, in every kitchen, in every restaurant in Champaign-Urbana, you will find the migrant population. I think that that's how great it is and how we need to step out and find a way to speak to those growing issues that are coming out of that.
Now, in terms of some of the social issues, where does spirituality fit in?
Well, I'm not sure that maybe I'm part of the Christendom kind of field, that I don't know if spirituality fits in as much as those are a part of spirituality, that spirituality is about all of life. And so as practicing congregations indicates, spirituality is also a way about being intentional, that many of us do ongoing practices that we do not refer to as spiritual because we believe we live in a secular context without that spirituality. I have a member of my congregation who came to me looking for spiritual direction and was already walking once a day, walking a labyrinth once a day, weightlifting throughout the week. And what she did not recognize was that those were spiritual practices that she was doing. She just needed the intention of knowing that God was involved in those ongoing practices in her life. I think that that's where we are stuck very often, is not recognizing that God is involved.
We're down to our last 9 or so minutes on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with our guest, Mike Mulberry. If listeners would like to call, we can still squeeze in some questions and comments. Do call us, 1-800-222-WILL, 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free line. In Champaign-Urbana, you can access several lines by punching in 333-9455. We're eager to have you join this conversation with comments, questions, positive, negative, whatever. Glad to have reactions. Mike, when you first came to Community Church, what were the goals that the congregation had for you? Because I know it's congregations these days go through studies and plans and anticipating a new pastor coming. What did they bring to you when you first walked through the door?
Well, I think it's in the UCC tradition, it's much like a job interview, is that each individual church can go out and select who they want as pastor. So there was a search committee, and I think what often happens in a congregation is that search committees develop a regular practice of meeting together and discerning where does God want us to go. And so out of that, I think the search committee had really developed a sense of what they wanted. And what they said to a person was they wanted to be known in the community as a justice-making and a justice-seeking church. I was excited and thrilled at that because I knew that that's who Community UCC had been with Jack. But I also knew that on a conference and association level that they were not as well known as they could have been, and was excited about the possibility about making that known and making it intentional.
We have another caller waiting on line number one. Go right ahead.
Hello, Pastor Mike. You mentioned earlier during your time, I think it was when you were in seminary in Tulsa, you mentioned a bumper sticker. Now, this might not seem very important, but it bothers me a little bit. You described that bumper sticker as reading, what was it, Russia's Ride?
Russia's Right.
Russian's Ride?
No.
What was it? I loathe and despise bumper stickers, but I might learn something here. Please
no.
Answer. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it was reference to Rush Limbaugh, of course, the conservative talk show host who, there were bumper stickers back in that time that said, Rush is Right. It was when I was pastoring a church in Wichita, Kansas.
But as I remember, you were saying that you would not find bumper stickers like that in the parking lot of your particular church you were serving, but they would be found throughout the rest of that area.
Yeah, and I think what I was referencing also is where I was a youth pastor in Morton, Illinois, you would find a number of those bumper stickers in the parking lot. And I think that was to a degree because UCC meant a blurring of identity at that time in which you didn't have to proclaim yourself as progressive or who you were. Everybody was welcome, and we didn't talk about issues that might create conflict because we wanted to keep the whole lot of us together. In Wichita, Kansas, there are plenty of options for folks who want to find conservative churches that have all the bells and whistles. There are not that many churches that offer progressive theology. And so I was basically saying is to be UCC or United Church of Christ in Wichita, Kansas is an intentional decision.
And what are some of the benefits that come to an individual and to a congregation that makes that choice?
Well, I think part of it is that as you begin to define yourself, you begin to make decisions based on your values and who you are, rather than the world acting upon you. I think that's one of the important things about as you identify your identity, because too often we go through life and then look back and say, oh, wow, this is when this happened to me and this drove me to this particular place in my life, instead of saying I had that value and so that's how I lived my life at this time. So we want folks to make choices based on their values, not because they get brought along the current of culture.
Now, some people would look at American culture and say that it's anti-religious. What do you think?
Again, I think that that's a mixed bag. I certainly think that there is a civic religion that is promoted night and day within our culture. And that, in effect, there have been some laws that have very much indicated that we give more to religion than we give to any other institution within our society. There's a good book written, God and the Gavel, I believe it is, that talks about how many communities have allowed child abuse or sexual abuse because religion is something that should be private, and in this religion, this was allowed. That's certainly not within our context and faith, but sometimes that has happened. So that civic religion, I think, is very important to this culture.
We have another caller on line one. Go ahead, please.
I'm trying to sort this out. Are you the pastor who is on campus noons handing out things to students as they go by?
That would not be me. No, I'm not on campus handing out things. That's not me.
So who would that be?
I have no idea who that would be. Although we do have a great campus minister that works out of our church, Reverend Karen Bush, who heads up the campus ministry at the University of Illinois.
But she would probably not be on campus handing out those kind of materials.
No, I don't think that that's Karen's style, but I could be wrong.
We've had Karen as a guest on this program because she's the current president of the National Campus Ministry Association. So people could call her and ask if that, who's doing that. If people have questions, more specific questions about your congregation, Mike, how may they contact you? Do you have a website?
Yep, we do have a website, www.community-ucc.org, or you can – this is kind of dangerous maybe. You can do my email at mike@community-ucc.org. And as you can tell by this evening, I welcome the discussion and the questions. I think that diversity feeds my faith, and I would love to hear folks who are empowered and enlivened about the possibility of practicing congregations in our communities.
And if people would like to attend a worship service, it's open to the public. Well, when do you have services?
10:15 on Sundays. We have Sunday school for adults and for children at 9 o'clock. The Sunday school uses the rotation model. So, and that means a story that's repeated over and over again through different mediums.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith has been Mike Mulberry, pastor at Community United Church of Christ in Champaign. I want to thank him and our callers for a good discussion of the practicing congregation movement. A quick announcement, the YWCA at the University of Illinois is celebrating its 20th annual Black Women's Achievement Dinner coming up on February 18 at the Round Barn Banquet Center. Dr. Zalima Harris, retiring president of Parkland College, will receive a special award. Jeanette Osler, who founded this dinner 20 years ago while serving as the YW executive director, will also be honored at the dinner. Jeanette, as many people in the community know, is now an educator, a teacher at Stratton Elementary School in Champaign. Recognition will be given to trailblazers and unsung achievers, as well as young achievers from a local high school. Tickets are $35 for adults, $17.50 for kids, can be ordered by calling the YWCA 344-0721. They can also email the Y and check find out from their website, YWCA of U of I, hotmail.com. So that's February 18, the Black Women's Achievement Dinner. The YWCA's mission, nationally and locally, is to empower women and eliminate racism. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Coming up next week, I'll be talking with Matthew Murray, a local poet. He'll be reading his poetry and talking about the creative process. On February 19, Youssef Estes will be our guest here on Keeping the Faith, sponsored by the Muslim Women's Outreach Group. He'll be speaking in Champaign-Urbana and talking about why priests and pastors, some of those folks, are accepting Islam. Hillel Hakim will be our guest February 26, talking about Christian churches and Israel. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
General Patton wrote in 1943 that war is very simple, direct, and ruthless. It takes simple, direct, and ruthless men to wage it. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, simple and direct conversations with the ruthless men and women who wage war. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. WILL is public radio, touching on every topic under the sun. You've been sampling some of our programs and now find that you're hooked. There's just one more topic to discuss. WILL receives almost half of its financial support from the community. Now that your listening time has increased, you may be ready to become someone who helps bring all the programs and services to the community. Ensure the future of public radio. Become a contributor. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with a low around 15 degrees and northwest winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with the high in the mid-30s and northwest winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low around 20 degrees and light winds. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.